Welcome, Sunita Gale, to the Picture House podcast. And we're here today to discuss your both excellent and vital directorial debut, Hostile, which just yesterday was longlisted for the Outstanding Debut BAFTA.
It's untold horrors that stand before us.
Any time they can say, you don't belong here, go back to my country.
They didn't deport me.
You've got no rights.
A threat to national security.
How exciting is that? Can you tell me about getting that phone call?
It wasn't a phone call, actually. I saw it online. However, I couldn't log in at the time. So I was frantically calling Jess, who's our assistant producer, and finding out what's happening. I couldn't access it online. So when I did access it, it just popped up. And I must say, I was really shocked. I was shocked. I was surprised. But I was really heartened by it and just so grateful, so much gratitude for that long list, because it was so unexpected. And I think that's because of the subject matter, that's because of the journey I've been on as a filmmaker, as an individual, to get this film out there. And I just thought it was an impossible task. It's the BAFTAs. This is an independent film. It hasn't gone through the normal channels. It hasn't had the industry backing. So to be longlisted for a BAFTA and to be recognised by an organisation that I recognise in such high regard, it is just an absolute honour. So thank you, BAFTA.
I couldn't agree more. And this is just what a film like this really needs, isn't it? Like, just that high profile, really quality backing from, or recognition from, such an institution. So that's just wonderful. So let's go back to the beginning. What was it that made you decide to make this extremely moving, and for many, it will be revelatory, documentary?
Thank you. That's such kind words. Really, the seed of the idea comes from my own background. You know, when the pandemic struck, I deeply reflected on my childhood experiences. You know, we were all locked in, into our houses, into our community, and our world changed overnight. And just being locked in and being locked into my community made me think about my childhood. I grew up in a very working class area where our community was everything. My mom worked in the factory. We had a convenience store that wasn't very far from our house. We went to the local school, the local gurdwara. Everything about the community was our lives. And I really thought about that. And I think perhaps I probably didn't appreciate it as much as a child. I appreciated it a lot more later on in life. And when the pandemic struck, I really started to think back to how things were and how reliant we were on our local community. And because of that, I decided to try and make a film about what it's like to be a migrant, living in this pandemic, and being able to what's happening right now within communities regarding migrants. So I wanted to make a film initially about how migrant communities were living during the height of the pandemic, what migrant communities were doing because of my own childhood. And that was really the seed of my idea, my childhood experiences, and then wanting to go out there and film and go to the very communities that I grew up in to see what was happening. What were migrants doing at that time? Because all I could see in the paper were that migrant communities were not just culturally providing, you know, something to our country, but at this time economically, they were the people that were the NHS workers, the train drivers, the taxi drivers. So I wanted to go out into communities to see what was happening within migrant communities and see what they were doing. And really, that was the start of my filmmaking process.
So was it quite a revelation to you just how bad it was then?
It absolutely was. I was making a completely different film. My starting point was to go into a community where migrants were keeping society moving and to kind of make a film about the positive contribution of migrants to our country and to see that positivity. And that was happening. I could see that around me. But at the same time, I could also see devastating stories emerging about the very migrants that were helping our society were the very migrants that were being targeted and vilified, not only by the media, but also by legislation and policy. that was the shock, that was the surprise, and that was the eye-opener. And as somebody who is from migrant parents, I just couldn't believe what I was witnessing and seeing. And so I couldn't stop. I had to keep going.
So tell me about the people that you chose to film, you know, your incredible subjects with their extraordinary stories and the soul-destroying stress of their situations. You know, how was it to film them, and how did you select, for want of a better word, the subjects that you chose?
Yeah, it is soul-destroying and heartbreaking to watch their unfolding narrative. My entry point was Daksha Vasani. I read the Kilbourne Times, and there was Daksha. And I thought, wow, here's a couple that's not too far from me in Brent that is, they're cooking at the height of the pandemic, 2,500 meals a week. It's a response kitchen, a food bank. And they were providing meals for NHS workers, local community, anyone that was struggling at that time. So my entry point to my story was Daksha. So off I went with myself and my cameraman, and we went to the kitchen and we met Daksha, and I was just absolutely amazed by her work ethic, her kindness, both her and Paresh, what they were doing. And that was my entry point, really. So the more I filmed Daksha, the more I understand, you know, who her, not her client base, the more I filmed Daksha and the more I understand who she was providing support for, the more I learned about no recourse to public funds, the more I learned about this terminology, the hostile environment. I knew nothing about no recourse to public funds until I met Daksha Vasani, because she was actually providing meals for people that were suffering from no recourse to public funds. And when she made that sort of suggestion to me and told me about it, I wanted to learn more. So Daksha was really my entry into the story and also into the students. She was providing meals to students, to NHS workers, to her local community. Basically, anyone that was struggling at that time could come to Daksha and get a hot meal. And she would do food deliveries, etc. And when she told me about the students, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it, because I have a 15-year-old son myself. And here they are, 18-year-olds, young adults, here as international students, who were really struggling and who were relying on food banks. And I didn't even know that this was happening. So she led me to the students. And when she led me to the students, she led me to Ilyas. So my story was kind of led by the participants. Daksha led me to the students to Ilyas. And as I started to unpick this unfolding narrative about no recourse to public funds, the hostile environment, I then wanted to learn more. And that then led me to Farouk Serre. And I read about Farouk in The Independent and him fighting against this cruel policy and legislation and consistently being let down and consistently not having his visa renewed, limited leave to remain, but not indefinite leave to remain, which he's been fighting for now for over 10 years. And I wanted to learn more. With Farouk, he came here as an international student. And he, like the students, came here to better their life, to get educated, to get a job, to provide to our country, both culturally and economically. He got married, settled here. And yet, 10 years later, still doesn't have his indefinite leave to remain. And as I was unpicking that story, I started thinking, hang on, there's something deeper here, there's something broader here. I knew about the Windrush scandal in 2017. I knew about that. Amelia Gentleman broke that for The Guardian, but I didn't really know the extent of the hostile environment. I'd watched Sitting in Limbo on TV, and I knew about Anthony Bryan. So I called up, I managed to get hold of him. I called Anthony. I remember the conversation really well. And I asked him to be part of this film. So I guess each participant really allowed me to unpick the story, and the access allowed me to understand more about this hostile environment. And so it was really them that led me to each participant. And I'm deeply grateful for that, because they trusted me with their stories. And for that, I'm deeply grateful.
They really did, didn't they? Because these people are under enough stress as it is. And to be filmed and to want to present their stories as as fairly and as honestly as possible. It's a big demand, you know, so I thought they were very generous. And tell me about getting the actual documentary made. So, you know, that you moved from what you thought was the documentary you were going to make into something completely different. So how difficult, sorry, was it for you to get funding? How did you get people like Nitin Sawhney on board and George the Poet? Wonderful contributors to the whole thing, yeah.
Oh, yeah, thank you so much. Lovely thing to say. It was tough. It was so difficult. I think those early days, April 2020, May 2020, June 2020, those 3 months, it was a boiling point. You know, we needed to make our film. We didn't have any money. We couldn't raise the finance and we were a small crew. And I look back on those months and think, how did we do it? How did we pull it off? Well, I'll tell you how we pulled it off. A lot of kindness from a lot of people, my crew, my team. I didn't get paid. My crew, they offered, they took pay cuts. My immediate team, we worked 7 days a week. My associate producer, we worked nonstop on this film and we gave everything. So it really was the kindness and generosity of people. I did apply for funding. I got rejected by everybody, even though I cut small samples, sizzles, I provided pitch documents. The appetite just wasn't there. And even though they liked the subject matter, I'm a debut director, maybe the story wasn't fleshed out enough for them. They just didn't feel like it was something they could take on. So I then had to put my own money into it, but then I went out to two other financiers and they came on board. That added another layer of stress because it was, now you're responsible for other people's money and you have to then really think about what you're spending. So it was three of us financing this and having to do it in a pandemic, adhering to the rules of the pandemic, keeping the participants and the crew safe, and then having to stretch the money out so that we could film what we needed to film in order to make the best film that we could. Simultaneously, having to be the producer, the writer, and the director, and then thinking about the participants, how I'm going to get the story, who's going to be in the film, my research, my documenting, and then reaching out to Nitin really was initially because we wanted to interview him. He had made just the most incredible albums, and a lot of his work is relatable to the migrant story. And I felt like he was the right person to speak in this film. So initially I reached out to his management about being an interviewee. And when I interviewed him in the studio, I wanted to really work with him with his music. So he ended up being an interviewee. Then he provided the music. And then I asked him to be my exec. And that process happened all along the filming and post-production process. So, and then George the Poet, I go home and that poem and that spoken word, it really rung sort of true to me with regards to the Brexit campaign. And it was something that just screams everything that's in this film. How migrants are vilified, targeted by the press, how the go home vans were everywhere during that campaign, how they were treated. And I just felt like I needed that poem. I needed that spoken word in the film. So he signed up to the film. So really it was a lot of, we just had to just do it. And it was a lot of phone calls, a lot of late nights, a lot of filming, a lot of research. I created an essay for every bit of research that I did that threaded the story together. We wrote essays just to make sure that we were on the right track. So it was a lot of work, I must say. It was a big undertaking.
Do you know what? I mean, as I was watching it and like all the threads coming together, the historical, the social, the racial, the economic, I did think, goodness me, you have put in so much work to this documentary and it really shows. It was utterly painstaking, but it makes it a beautiful, I want to say hard, but good watch for someone who doesn't know anything about it. You know, I feel so educated now about what, you know, as a start to start this dialogue that needs to happen, this vital dialogue that needs to happen right now. So what are your feelings about documentaries now almost being the news? Because this is not in the mainstream media, is it?
No, it's not. I think the mainstream media are very scared to report this. I think, you know, 2017, Amelia Gentleman was great in terms of breaking the Windrush scandal. But I feel from that point onwards, very little has been addressed in the news regarding the hostile environment. And unsurprisingly, I think it's because, you know, things have been operating in stealth with the new points-based system, with the Nationality and Borders Bill, with the police bill. All of these things have come about since 2017. So whilst nothing's been shown in the press, whilst nothing's been reported, legislation and policies have been put in place that is going to make things a lot worse, not just for migrants, but for us all. And I think that's the frightening thing about this, is that whilst we've not been reporting it because the news outlets are just too scared to report it, the government have been able to do what they want to do, and that is to bring about policy. I mean, passing the Nationality and Borders Bill, and being a second generation migrant myself, who potentially is eligible to dual citizenship, and being told that potentially your British citizenship could be revoked, is deeply frightening. With the police bill, not being able to protest freely is deeply frightening. Now with the points-based system, you can't come into the country unless you have 70 points, unless you earn a certain amount of money. Deeply frightening. So, you know, since the press haven't been reporting any of this, the government have been bringing about policy and legislation and passing it and carrying on. And I just think it's worrying. So I give thanks to outlets like Byline Times, you know, George Monbiot, and, you know, Baker Street Herald, you know, and I go to places like that where I find journalism at its heart and journalism that has integrity and honesty. So that's where I go now to find my news. Double Down News is incredible. Navarra Media, all of these places you could go to find independent journalism, because we're not getting it in the mainstream news, which is frightening. And things are changing. You know, the polls are shifting. People are waking up and realizing that our current government isn't doing what they're saying they're doing. And I think that's indicative in what's happened recently. And I think that things are changing. I hope, I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful that things will change for the better.
Absolutely, and we need to think that. I mean, there are so many things that watching your documentary brought up for me. And one of them, I sent you the poem by Martin Niemöller, and then they came for me, you know, and just that idea that, okay, well, it's not me now, you know, but it could be, it will be, you know, that it's a kind of cannibalism that we're in at the moment, in a way, this authoritarianism. It doesn't just stop with the people that it's at, you know, it will, it's a machine, it will carry on, you know. I mean, it's almost farcical that the person who's introducing this legislation could herself be deported by the legislation. It's beyond any kind of Lewis Carroll imaginings.
And I think that was the thing. Whilst I was filming, I kept on asking myself the question, what happens when the hostile environment turns on me? What happens when it turns on us all? I would say that to my team. I feel like this is a testing ground. I feel like there's things to come. And, you know, we filmed for 18 months from April 2020 till September 2021, around that sort of time we finished our post-production. And during that time, all I kept on thinking was that this is a testing ground for things to come. I didn't know about the Nationality and Borders Bill at that time, even though now we've been to two protests, we're going to another one tomorrow. You know, it's frightening. And yet our assumptions at the end of the film is that, you know, this could turn on us, and it's turning on us with the police bill, because here we are, everybody is going to be targeted because of this police bill, you know. And I think that was the starting point. Let's just scoop everybody up, gypsy, Roma, travellers, sex workers, anyone that wants to protest, you know, let's just scoop them all up and let's just put in legislation that's going to stop them from doing everything. And now we have it with the Nationality and Borders Bill, where it's taking the hostile environment to another level. And my assumption is, and this is frightening, next, will we be targeting British citizens that family have been here for generations and just remove them because we can? So it feels like that's where we're heading. But it started off with migrants, and now it's going to migrants that have dual citizenship to then British citizens. And it's extremely authoritarianism. It's extremely autocratic, and it's worrying times. So yeah, thanks for picking that up.
It is worrying times, but like you say, there is hope. And at the moment, we are still allowed to protest and we can fight. So what are the suggestions that the film comes up with that people can do?
Yeah, I mean, what I've seen, language is a gateway to an attitude. George the poet says that language is a gateway to an attitude. Well, let's change the language. We are going to change the narrative. As filmmakers, we're going on a cinema tour with the film. We're going into local communities. What we can do is start dialogue, change the language together as communities, build bridges. You know, don't set to divide us, set to bring us together. What language can we use to bring us together? This film will highlight significant flaws in our society, but how can we change that language? How can we build bridges between communities? So our initial thing is to go into communities, use our film as a toolkit to start the language and dialogue around the hostile environment, why people are struggling, how they're struggling, how we can help them. We have a website, hostiledocumentary.com. On there is a letter that you can print off and send to your local MP. On there is our cinema date. On there are clinics where you can go to actually address the issues that you have. So it's all about communicating within your local community and then seeking out help with grassroots organisations, your local MP. Our intention is to build from grassroots level to eventually go into organisations like JCWI, NRPF Network, Unity, speak at these organisations with the eventual hope to go to Parliament. When we're in Parliament, we'll have MPs from the left and the right, and then to hopefully change policy and legislation. That's our aim as filmmakers. But what people can do is they can watch the film, they can have a conversation, they can tell a friend, they can print off the letter, they can send it to their MP. It's all about raising awareness, starting conversation, and understanding that this exists. And the seriousness of it, you know, we have a climate crisis, we have a political crisis, we have so many crises right now, and it's about coming together as a country, as a community, and start thinking about the things that make us similar as opposed to things that set us apart. What are our similarities? Let's focus on those and not focus on our differences. And that's when we start building bridges in our society and creating a society that's fairer for all. And that's what we want to do with this film as filmmakers, is build those bridges within communities that are unaware of this narrative around the hostile environment.
Exactly. And also, I think that you start to piece together a vision for the future, which I think is absolutely vital as well. You know, fundamentally, I do believe that humans are kind. And I think that we can build a kind and fair society in the future. So I just want to add, before I say goodbye, that you're doing a Picture House Q&A tour, as well as part of all the wider community, because unfortunately there isn't a Picture House in every community. And it's a long, extensive tour going from Finsbury Park on January the 21st through to Stratford on March the 3rd. So throughout February, you'll be touring our Picture Houses, which is just so exciting. I can't thank you enough, Sunita, for joining me today and for making this incredible documentary. And really good luck with the BAFTA. I mean, whatever happens, the fact that it's been recognised is just so wonderful. And I'm so pleased for you. And I hope that we get to speak again one day soon.
Yeah, thank you, Picture House. Thank you for believing in the film. And thank you for the interview today. Really appreciated it.